This is what the border family separation crisis sounds like.
I would cite you to the Apostle Paul and his clear and wise command in Romans 13 to obey the laws of the government.
The United States should be better than this.
What people are forgetting, they just want to listen to those tapes. You know, I can take you to any nursery and you're going to hear the exact same thing.
Essentially, summer camps.
Very large cages.
We are enforcing the laws passed by Congress.
A girl with Down syndrome taken from her mother and put in a cage.
I read
about a did you say want to a 10-year-old?
Three tender age shelters in South Texas. Lawyers and medical providers. Just, I think I'm gonna have to hand this off.
Hidden away from public view. What country is that?
As a result of Democrat-supported loopholes in our federal laws, most illegal immigrant families and minors from Central America who arrive unlawfully at the border cannot be detained together or removed together, only released.
2,342 children have been separated from their parents at the U.S.-Mexico border over 36 days, according to the Department of Homeland Security. And the Associated Press reported yesterday that the Trump administration has also been taking young children and even babies from their parents and putting them in so-called tender age shelters. Lawyers and medical personnel who visited the shelters told the AP that they saw sobbing preschool-age children who were, quote, in crisis. There are three of these centers for very young children and babies, and the administration is planning to build a fourth. At a pro-business meeting in Washington on Tuesday, President Trump defended his administration's zero-tolerance policy that allows migrant children to be separated from their parents at the border. And he also proposed a solution.
So what I'm asking Congress to do is to give us a third option, which we have been requesting since last year, the legal authority to detain and promptly remove families together as a unit.
Today, however, the administration has chosen to change their policy, drafting an order to end family separations.
We want security for our country. The Republicans want security and insist on security for our country, and we will have that. At the same time, we have compassion. We want to keep families together. It's very important. I'll be signing something in a little while that's going to do that. And the people in this room want to do that.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega, broadcasting again from Minnesota Public Radio. And today, a look inside two types of facilities currently being used to hold migrant parents and their children. We begin in Brownsville, Texas. You may remember that last month, Senator Jeff Merkley of Oregon was denied access to the Casa Padre detention facility. And we spoke to him on this program after that failed attempt.
I'm blaming the President of the United States. I'm blaming the Attorney General. I'm blaming the head of Homeland Security for what is happening at that facility.
So last week, I went on a media tour of the former Walmart shelter.
That's Manny Fernandez, a Houston bureau chief for the New York Times, who was granted access just last week.
This is the shelter that's been in the news. It's in Brownsville. Brownsville is basically the southern tip of Texas, right at the border. And it is in a standard-looking Walmart, you know, strip mall. They've taken out the Walmart signs. It's run by a nonprofit group called Southwest Key.
Near the entrance, there's a series of presidential murals, including one of President Trump, accompanied by a quote in English and Spanish.
The quote reads, "Sometimes by losing a battle, you find a new way to win the war."
Fernandez gained access through a media tour approved and coordinated by the facility.
There are roughly 1,500 boys inside that former Walmart today. Those boys range in age from 10 to 17. And then in addition to that, there's about 1,000 employees that work there. And so it's just, it really is a massive facility. It's actually hard to get your hands and your head around it, even after you do a tour.
Fernandez said the Casa Padre facility felt like walking through a school before the bell rings.
There was a lot of kids talking, but it wasn't unorderly. You would see 10 or 12 boys in a line, and then you would see two or three staff members right next to them. And you would see the boys they were eating dinner at cafeteria tables, and sitting with them at the edge of each table was an employee who was sort of there, obviously, to sort of eat with them and also to be there in case there's any issues, in case any fights broke out or whatever, to sort of assist them.
Signs posted along the facility hallways instructed employees to call police if they're approached by the media.
There were specific moments when I sort of forgot that I was in a Walmart. One of them was when we saw a Tai Chi class happening. So we were in sort of like a rec room, which is very large, very open area. A lot of boys kind of hanging around, watching TV. There were pool tables. It's probably an exaggeration to call it a mini city, but it's not that far from the truth.
And on the surface, Fernandez said, the kids seemed okay.
In my brief visit, I didn't see a lot of anguish in the boys, and I was looking for it. I think all the reporters who were in there were looking for signs of anguish and trauma, and it was hard to see on the surface among the boys. The boys came up to us. Many of them said hello. Many of them waved. I shook a lot of their hands. They seemed happy, at least in that moment.
But beneath the facade of a buzzing boy shelter, there are signs of strain.
I got the fire inspection records for that facility from the city of Brownsville. And that shelter has had 12 fire inspections since it opened in 2017. They've passed 10, but they failed two. And those two that they failed were fairly recently in April and May. And so those failed fire inspections were never mentioned, obviously. They try to put the best face they could on that facility, but it's clear that just as in running any large school or any large homeless shelter or any other large institution, you're going to have problems. There's going to be problems with the staff. There's going to be problems with compliance with state issues. And this facility is no different.
And community support for the facility is waning.
You know, on the surface, these facilities seem to be doing okay. And yet, beneath the surface, the view of a lot of people, at least locally, who sort of have liked these shelter operators and these groups that run these shelters, they've been fans of them. But now they're sort of wondering, you know, why do they have their hands in the middle of this? And is that proper and is it moral?
Sixty miles away from Brownsville, Zoe Carpenter, associate Washington editor with The Nation, visited a Border Patrol processing facility in McAllen, Texas, and she also saw signs of strain on the system.
They have computers set up for migrants to do virtual processing with Border Patrol agents who are in other cities because they simply don't have enough agents at this facility to deal with the number of people that are coming through.
The 77,000 square foot facility is nicknamed Ursula, and it's struggling to handle the influx of immigrants.
You know, I was at other places in the border, at a couple of other facilities too, and the impression that I was left with overall is just a system that's really being strained and is struggling to catch up to this policy that was made in Washington far away from the realities of the border.
I spoke with Zoe Carpenter about what it's like on the inside.
So this was a Border Patrol processing facility in McAllen, Texas, which is right on the U.S.-Mexico border in the Rio Grande Valley. And it's one of the busiest crossing points for migrants coming from Mexico. I gained access with other reporters on a press tour that was set up by the Border Patrol, and they gave us, I would say, maybe 20, 25 minutes of access inside the facility. We were not allowed to interview most of the people there. There were a few conversations that we had very briefly with adults through the fences that they were kept in, but we weren't allowed to talk to any of the children that were there.
And how is it divided? Are children separated from their parents? Are adults, men, women, like how, what is the structure?
So this facility has come to be known by some people as the dog kennel. And, you know, that actually is a pretty appropriate description because people are kept in these large wire mesh or chain link fence areas. And they're separated according to age and gender and family status. So there are areas for women and children and men and children together. And then there are areas for men alone and women alone. And then there are sections for children who are alone. At the time that I was there, there were about 200 children on on their own in that facility. Some of them had come across the border on their own. So those are the unaccompanied minors. And then some of the children that were alone had been separated from their parents in that facility.
Tell us about the children that you saw who had been separated from their parents. Were these kids able to interact with you at all, or were they showing any signs of distress?
Well, we weren't able to tell which children had been separated from their parents in the facility and which had come across the border on their own because they're kept together and were not identified to us. So the children looked about as young as 5 and then up into teenagers. And this is the sort of first step facility. So it's a very sparse facility. It's not at all set up for children to be there for a long time, although some of them are there ultimately for a few days. And so they're in basically a large cage with some mats on the floor, some of the silver Mylar blankets, but there's really nothing else in terms of books or toys or things for them to do.
You mentioned the word cage. We've seen images of these structures. Now, the Border Patrol weighed in and they told CBS News that they were, quote, very uncomfortable, unquote, with the use of that word, cages. How do you square that with what you saw?
Well, I don't know really what else to call a enclosure of chain link fencing. It's we can quibble with semantics, but at the end of the day, there are more than 1,000 people in this facility who are in pens. Regardless of what you want to call it, that is the situation.
Tell us a little bit about the migrants. You know, are these folks who are, I'm assuming, literally coming here with the clothes on their backs?
Yeah, it was quite alarming to walk in and see so many people crammed together in these pens. You know, this has been a very difficult journey for many of them. We talked to one woman who'd traveled from Honduras and it had taken her over a month to get across the border. And so people look tired, they look confused, and obviously it's an incredibly stressful experience, especially if you have young children with you.
And as far as the conditions, what were some of the sights, sounds, smells for those of us who aren't there?
It's very sparse. People are moving in and out all the time. It's pretty quiet, almost eerily quiet. People are having hushed conversations. There was a little bit of joking in when we first walked in and we walked past an area where some of the men who were kept alone, and they were kind of joking with us and calling out and things like that, and clearly were looking for a distraction because there's, you know, it's very boring to be in a place like that. But for the amount of people that are in there, I was surprised that there just seemed to be this sense of suspense and waiting, and they might be waiting days, but there's still this, I don't know, there's you definitely feel this sense of dread when you're in there because people don't know what's going to happen to them next.
Zoe Carpenter is Associate Washington Editor with The Nation. Zoe, thanks for your work and for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
And we want to give you an update on another immigration story we've been following. Back in early March, we heard from the Pukris, a family of 5 living in New Jersey. The parents, Vitor and Neta, came to the United States from Albania 17 years ago. They were fleeing political persecution and a feud that they said would have left them dead. Their 2 sons, who are 21 and 26 years old, were born in Albania and were also DACA recipients. And their 10-year-old daughter is an American citizen. The parents came to the United States with a visa that expired a couple years later, and they were living with no documentation. In February, they met with ICE because they thought they had won the green card lottery. Here's the oldest son, Bepin.
Happiest day of our life, actually. We thought, this is it. Everything we've been working so hard for, sacrificing for, finally happened.
It turns out, though, that ICE had different intentions. Vitor was detained and Neta was put on house arrest.
The only thing I remember is my dad standing there with like his papers in his hands. He was trying to give her the papers because she was clearly not paying attention to any of them. He was just holding them in his hands. He's like, please, I have a family. How could you do that? We have everything, everything. And then the ICE agents, they just kind of told me like, nothing. They just said, go outside. We're taking your parents, pretty much.
In April, a few weeks after we spoke to them, Vitor was deported. As that was happening, ICE also detained Neta and Michael, saying that they tried to interfere with Vitor's deportation. And as of yesterday afternoon, Neta was on the tarmac at Newark International Airport awaiting deportation back to Albania. As for Vitor, one immigration organizer who's been in touch with the family told us that the day after Vitor arrived back in Albania, he was attacked by armed men in masks and has since fled to Italy.
When we spoke to them back in March, they talked about their love for the United States and their support of President Trump.
Oh, God, I made everybody to vote for him. I wanted him to win so badly.
It's kind of like
it sucks.
It sucks because everybody's telling me, do you see what is happening with you now? A guy called me from Germany, actually. He called me, he said, I heard this and this for your documents. I said, yeah. And he said, I told you that guy gonna deport people. I said, what are you gonna do?
It sucks. It really sucks. Like I said, our circumstances suck. But we believe it's best for the country. At the end of the day, honestly, that's what matters, is making America great again. We believe that.
We're trying to reach Neta and Vitor and their kids, Michael, who's still in detention, and Bepin, who's looking after their 10-year-old daughter, Angela. We'll bring you another update on their story as soon as we can. And we want to hear from you on the president's zero tolerance policy at the border. And that includes the separation of kids from their parents. Do you support the president's policy or not?
Hello, my name is Chris from Quilcene, Washington on the Olympic Peninsula. No child should be punished for any illegal act of a parent, especially if the illegal act of the parent is running for his or her life. We have a social and moral obligation to look at our country's part in creating conditions from which people have to flee.
My name's John Locke. I'm calling from Vine Grove, Kentucky. I 100% support this administration's zero tolerance policy on illegal immigrants because we have too many illegal immigrants, and something needs to be done to discourage it.
My name is Joshua. I am calling from Miramar, and I think it's reprehensible what Republicans are doing with this zero tolerance policy and using the Bible as justification for immoral behavior.
My name is Nicole, calling from Columbia, South Carolina. People who come into this country don't want to be illegal, and we don't want illegal immigrants. They want to pay taxes, they want to work, they want to be here safely and legally, and I think we have an obligation to create pathways so that they can do that.
Hi, my name's Grace. I'm calling from Miami, Florida. I don't think that kids should be torn away from their families. It's very traumatizing for the child. I come from an immigrant family, but I don't think that the way that they're handling the situation is the best one, and there should be a different alternative. I just hope to see that somehow both sides of the parties can come to a mutual consensus and figure this out.
My name is Julio Martinez. I'm calling from Miami, Florida, and I'm with the president on all his decisions.
Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Again, 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can also tweet me at Tanzina Vega. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed, to me. It's a good day to think of that poem inscribed at the bottom of the Statue of Liberty, because today is World Refugee Day. But what do those words mean in 2018 in light of our current immigration policies? According to a report released today by the International Rescue Committee, the United States is accepting fewer and fewer refugees. So far this year, there's been a 71% drop in refugee arrivals to the United States. Here to discuss the report's findings is David Miliband, president and CEO of the International Rescue Committee. David, thanks so much for being with us.
It's very good to be with you. Thanks for having me on.
So before we even get into the report, I want to ask you about the 71% drop. What is driving that? Is that purely about the Trump administration's policies and rhetoric about refugees? Are there other impetuses?
Well,
because that is
not
a gigantic
drop.
It is.
It's certainly not the lack of refugees in the world, because on World Refugee Day every year, the United Nations publishes the figures for the number of refugees around the world, and it's at record levels. 68 million people displaced by conflict and persecution. About 25 million of them cross borders as refugees. 40 million of them stay within their own home countries, but are homeless, and 3 million are the asylum seekers of the kind that you're seeing on the southern border at the moment. The explanation for the 71% fall in the number of refugees who are being admitted to the United States is a policy question. The Trump administration inherited a situation where more or less every American president since Ronald Reagan had been admitting about 90,000 refugees a year. Actually, Ronald Reagan, at the height of the Vietnamese boat crisis, in the aftermath of that, in the early 1980s, he admitted 200,000 a year. The Trump administration said, we're only going to admit 45,000. So that was a halving of the numbers. But actually, in enforcing the policy, they're admitting only 21,000. So you're seeing these extraordinary drops in the number of refugees, not just Muslims, an 80% drop in the number of Muslim refugees, but also a 60% drop in the number of Christian refugees. So this is a massive U-turn on America's extraordinary history in this area.
And let's talk a little bit about that history. And I just want to be clear, is it that these are folks who are arriving and not being admitted, or are these folks, the 71% drop is just folks have stopped coming
entirely? No, I use the term admissions very carefully, because the 71% drop is the deliberate policy decision by the administration to reduce the number of refugees who are admitted to this country under the Refugee Resettlement Program. That's an organized, planned transfer of refugees from countries like Kenya or Ethiopia or Lebanon or Jordan to this country. You've then got a separate issue, which is the crossings of the southern border and people claiming asylum. Actually, some of those numbers are down as well. But that's a different issue that's come into the headlines most recently. And obviously, you've seen the difficulties that the administration has caused, not just for children and families, but for themselves in the different positions they've been taking.
Now, many people, especially those who are rallying against against migrants and refugees, and we've heard from some of people who say they completely agree with these policies, this assumption, this rhetoric that we are hearing, not just from our president, but we also did a segment yesterday on how this is spreading increasingly in Europe, very anti-immigrant, anti-refugee rhetoric, which is basically saying that by bringing in more refugees, we're going to increase crime and jobs are going to be taken away. Can we talk about the facts behind that?
I mean, I know it's unfashionable to have facts in place of
emotion. No, not here. On the takeaway,
exactly,
we love
that
facts.
I was about to say. So thanks, thank goodness for the takeaway that's willing to be a fact-full zone and not a fact-free zone. Look, first of all, the fact is that 60% of Americans say that they actually think this country should welcome refugees. Secondly, the president, from the top down, he said Germany is suffering a crime wave because of the refugees who have arrived there. Wrong. Crime is at the lowest level since 1992 in Germany. Third, people often say, but there's not proper vetting of refugees who are arriving. Actually, it's more difficult to get to America as a refugee than by any other route. It's 18 months of careful vetting by the FBI, the CIA, all sorts of agencies in the run-up to the refugee resettlement process. And then the final fact, which I think is important as well, people often worry, well, are these people going to be claiming welfare benefits? Actually, the fact is that refugees pay more in taxes than they receive in welfare benefits. So when you look at the facts, you realize that resettling...
Let's just make sure people understand that, that refugees are paying taxes.
They're paying taxes because they're getting jobs. And one of the great things about the American system is that it's work first. After 3 months of benefits that support you for the initial period of your stay in the United States, all the effort is to get you into work. And of course, work is a great integrator as well as a great contributor. So refugees pay more in taxes as employees. They're also 30% more likely to create businesses than the host population. Remember, these people are accountants and physical trainers as well as factory workers and farmers from places around the world, and they are fleeing for their lives. This is the baker from Damascus whose house is bombed by President Assad. It's the girls in northeast Nigeria who are chased from their homes by Boko Haram, the terrorist group. These are people who know the value of freedom. So when they arrive here, they're determined to make the most of it.
So let's also talk about what's driving refugees. And you mentioned some of that. But we also can't ignore that some of the advisors in your organization, including Madeleine Albright and Colin Powell and Henry Kissinger, have also been linked to very aggressive U.S. foreign policy actions that some would argue have destabilized and increased flow of refugees.
But it's an important point to look at the causes of this. And the cause at the moment, remember, there are record numbers of people fleeing war and persecution today than in the days of Madeleine Albright or others. But nonetheless, you're right to point out that there is a crisis of diplomacy around the world. The wars that are producing the flows of refugees in Syria, in South Sudan, the persecution in Burma, Myanmar, of the Rohingya population, 800,000 arriving in Bangladesh over the last 9 months. That is a symptom of the failure of diplomacy. And so one of the points we make to the administration is don't just take refugees here. Don't just be a good aid provider, but invest in diplomacy. And so it's worrying to hear the administration say that they don't just want to cut the number of refugees coming here. They don't just want to cut the amount of humanitarian aid that the United States gives. They also want to cut the diplomatic service, because, of course, this is a time when we need more effective diplomacy, not less diplomacy.
Well, and obviously, you mentioned earlier what's happening on the southern, the U.S.-Mexico border. Particularly, I'm curious to your reaction about the separation policy that has been implemented. Just this morning, we reported on the new facilities that are being built for babies. And that's right, babies. So I'm wondering, what is your reaction to that decision?
The first reaction is, as a father, utter horror. My father was a refugee, actually. And he fled from Nazi-occupied Belgium to the UK with his father. The idea that he would be torn away, he was 16 at the time, so he wasn't as young as the people you're talking about. So first, sheer horror. Secondly, this country, if it stands for anything, stands for generosity of spirit and human values. And the disjunction between the commitment to family values on the one hand and the tearing apart of families on the other sticks in the craw. But it's also important to recognize these are people exercising the legal right to flee from countries where they are unsafe and to claim asylum, to have their case properly heard. The people who are fleeing from El Salvador, from gang violence in Honduras or Guatemala. And the United States is a signatory to the 1951 Refugee Convention, actually.
I don't know how much longer we will be. We seem to be pulling out of many human rights policies as it is.
Well, that's a good point. The U.S. has, for the last 70 years, been the anchor of the global system. Sometimes it's made mistakes, sometimes big mistakes. But it's always been clear about what the benchmark of values that it's willing to stand by. It would be a tragedy, not just for the U.S., but for the wider world, to see it retreat from those deepest commitments. And let's be clear, that's not just more human suffering. But when humanitarian issues are not addressed, there's more political instability. It's a true vicious circle.
David Miliband is president and CEO of the International Rescue Committee. David, thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much.
And finally today, a huge thanks to all our friends here at Minnesota Public Radio for having us here for the last 2 days, especially our tech director, Corey Schreppel, reporter Don Crocker, and managing editor Meg Martin, not just for all the help here in the studio, but for also for the excellent food recommendations. We'll be back, St. Paul. In the meantime, I'm back with you from New York tomorrow. Until then, thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.